This is the Moonifest Destiny podcast, number 34. Moonifest Destiny is a novel I wrote in 1991. My name is Peter Gelman. The subtitle of the novel is The Rough and Ready Balloon Invasion of the Lunar Peninsula of Texas. If this is the first time you're listening, please go back and start with episode 1. Moonifest Destiny is available on Kindle for 99 cents. It is also available on Kindle in other countries. I will now read chapter 33, Pursuit. I limped slowly along the tent rows of the Army of Observation, Plato's crater dark and silent, across the cold sea, a quarter mile to the southwest. Eastward, I followed the trodden road, the newly won communications between Fort Texas at the tip of Timmy's Promontory and Fort Polk at Archie's Hole. Looked like the war was over. There wasn't a single mooner left in the P of T, not counting the dying. I felt proud about us regulars doing our job right well, without complaining. And I felt ready to call the Army life quits. The last commissary wagons and canteeners passed me with their mounted escorts at the very end of the long column. Captain Sewell's trail had joined this road, so I was no longer following their particular track. After the chuck wagons came the red-clotted hospital carts and litter bearers, and a ranger scout in buckskins drifted overhead in his dirty little balloon, paddles rowing slow and easy, heading south. "Helloa!" I called him. "Helloa up there, ranger!" He stopped rowing and looked down. "I'm looking for Captain Sewell," I shouted. "Important message, sir. He's on mounted patrol with about 10 men and a woman." The ranger pulled open his spyglass and looked north and east. Then he pointed towards Milliam's U.S. Bond crater. "Thank ye kindly," I called, waving my kepi. His shadow stretched a mile east, pointing my way over the trampled wastes and a littered path of the lunar route. Muskets abandoned, bayonets stuck in the soil, packs spilled along the seashore, pennants painted gold with angels, and flaming swords tangled in the boot-mangled cactus. A half a mile more took me to the heap and broken fields, still smoldering here and there. Still did smoke stain the purpling sky. Sprawled in my path lay a dead lunar boy with bright white trousers, bare feet, and a dark blue army coat upset where his stomach spilled open. I passed the last hospital tent. Its voluminous canopy glowed bright yellow in the darkening afternoon. The last pickets were lax, exhausted. They leaned their chins on the muzzles of their muskets. They let me pass with a simple, "I'm looking for our lost mule." I walked on through the scattered clumps of lunar dead, befuddled by the sight, but still searching for Captain Sewell, Sarah, and the metal man. After a lonely while, I thought I'd settle for Six Fingers Bordet. From somewhere I heard a cry. Some of the dead were still dying. Where was he? I heard the whine and sputter of a horse. I saw it struggling along, limping a little. It was an enormous stallion, white as steam. It was the biggest I'd ever seen. I heard the shout, "Catch him!" I saw him first. A doughboy was running over. I hurried to the horse. When I touched his neck, his great white head jerked up and down. "What's wrong with your leg, boy?" On this side, he looked healthy and strong, except for his crazy eyes and hanging tongue. I looked under. Something was tangled to the side of it, which made it limp. A hussar corpse dragged along with one boot still caught in the stirrup. The sentry who had shouted, his pockets stuffed to bursting, laughed a little as he ran up to the horse, only to curse as he eyed its lame leg. "It isn't that bad," I said. "Oh, it isn't that bad," he says, said the man. "Look at that piece of iron sticking out there." A slender shard had embedded in the poor horse's muscle. "Hold the reins," he told me. He snuck his hands in the pockets of the lunar hussar and found a brightly embroidered cloth, needled by a wife or mother, perhaps. Opening it, he found some paper pesos, which he cursed and threw to the side. He wiped his brow with the cloth and threw it down, too. He looked at the flintlock pistol and its ornately carved powder horn. He set them beside him. He thought for a moment, then unbuttoned the collar of the corpse. "Eureka! I knew it!" he cried, snatching up the cross from around the dead neck. He held it up. It was silver. It was an amulet, useless, but for its weight and greed now. A bad luck charm. He glanced at me threateningly, as if I challenged his claim to the bounty. Both he and the hussar were handsome, blue-eyed fellows, one with the solemn pallor of total resignation, the other ruddy with the sunburnt flesh of victory. The doughboy grabbed the hussar's ear and sawed at it with his knife. "What are you doing?" I asked. "I know a feller, a Texan, who'll pay a dollar an ear. Bet you wish you knew him too, but you don't." He looked at me. "Tell you what, though, I'll go 50-50 with you. I'll pay you 50 cents, a lunar ear." He went back to his sawing. Finally, he finished and dropped the grim thing in his haversack. "Let's bandage up this horse," I suggested. "Got any spirits with you, friend?" He smiled, the sunset in his eyes. "No, I'm bone dry too." "Well, let's fix this horse. Then you move along. This here's my stretch of stuff. I'm looking for Captain Sewell's patrol. Think I'll call this horse Old Whitey, like Taylor's horse. Let's make a splint so it don't get worse, then take her to the horse doctor." "Hell no! Hell no! Horse doctor'll confiscate him. I saw him first. You heard me. He's mine now." "Handsome, ain't he? I can doctor him myself." He tore some rags from the hussar's trousers. "Hold on tight now. He ain't a-gonna like it none. But faster than a rattler." I stroked the horse's neck. The man squatted down, lifted his hands, and licked his lips, like he was getting ready to pounce. I hugged the horse's head. The man's hand darted, and the horse lifted me up and dropped me, but I held on to the reins. Between me and the corpse, the horse couldn't run. "It's stuck," said the man, now missing his kepi. "Gotta get a grip on it." "Whoa, boy, whoa." Lather dripped from the horse's lip. I said, "I was wondering if maybe we oughtn't to let him run if he wants to." Thinking that this kind of doctoring was either going to make the horse's heart go bust or the brute was going to kick the doughboy's skull in. "You mean let it work itself out?" the man said, uncomprehending. "No time for that." Gently, he put his hands on either side of the wound, then put his mouth up to the wound to grab the iron in the pliers of his teeth. The horse screamed and knocked me back. It stumbled and then jumped forward. It hobbled off fast, dragging the corpse behind it. The other man got up with a bloody lip. He shook his head, dizzy. He spat out the iron shard, triumphant, and ran after the horse. But it was too fast. I could see the black shadow of it rushing along insanely, dragging the corpse. The man came back. "You didn't hold him," he complained. As I walked away, he called, "Hey there, you're bleeding. Want me to get you to the hospital?" The vigor of walking and the blow of the horse had broken some of the crust of the scabs on my back. In spots, my blouse stuck to my wounds. As I kept walking, the man shouted, "Keep a sharp lookout for them lobos." The ground was rising up to the lip of the crater. I lost myself to the heaped and broken fields, heavy with heaped bodies on busted earth and busy little devourers. How many hundreds of draining corpses heaped on the shell-pocked bloody crust of the moon. Too many for the victors to bury that day, to the waffling and grunting delight of the big black birds and the waddling armadillos and the hungry little mice. And Prince President Franklin's stove? As it got darker, I saw a light high on the lip of the crater. It was a fire. I headed that way. After a while, I smelled horses. They sat in the wreckage of abandoned Camp Tranquility. Captain Sewell was sitting on a lunar army stool beside a ranger and the engineer, Captain Mansfield. Sewell was looking through a gilt box of lunar maps. One cotton baler strolled just beyond the ring of light, a guard. A couple other sharpshooters huddled in blankets beside the fire, chatting. They had piled a heap of lunar sabers, pikes, pistols, even a little cannon. As I crept closer, I recognized the guard, Everett Higgleson, by his black eye from the subterranean tussle between companies F and H. "Sst! Everett! Everett! It's me, Jack. Jack, what are you doing here? Where's Sarah?" Captain Sewell stood up. "That Jack Borginis?" "Yes, sir." "What are you doing outside the fort?" "Got permission to look for the mule, sir." I came over. He looked at the scrap of paper Kelly had given me. "You can't look in the dark. Go on back." "Did you find the metal man, sir?" Sewell looked back at Mansfield. Mansfield looked back at the ranger, Wallace Gordon, who said, "I tracked him this far. Just before sunset, I thought I saw him in the valley down there, through my spyglass. We'll take it up again tonight, if the earth comes out of the clouds." "Captain," I asked, "where's my wife?" Sewell looked at me, chewing his cigar. "I'll tell you straight and hope you can take it like a man. She's not your wife anymore." "I want to hear it from her, sir, if you please, sir." "Well, I don't blame you, but it will have to wait. Go on back, Borginis." "Do you think that metal man is a deserter, sir, or a spy, or a madman. Sir, do you think that mental man is a deserter, or a spy, or a madman? I have no idea. That's what I aim to find out. I don't know if we can hang federal property, but I'm supposing we can. Captain, where's Sarah? Sewell said, I'll tell you, but only if I first hear you say she's not your wife anymore. I don't want trouble. Sarah is the same as she always was, Captain. I won't make no trouble. Sewell turned and pointed to one of the three enormous lunar officers' tents beyond the pale of the campfire. Who is it now? I asked. Bordet, he said. Well, him being a Mormon and all, maybe this one would stick. Since now maybe she's one of his five wives, maybe it won't matter to her that she's not going to have any of his children, there being plenty around. But those children were so far away. Even so, I doubted this marriage would stick. Poor Cactus Queen, I thought. Maybe I should pity Six Fingers, I thought again. Well, that was that, wasn't it? The war was over, and so was my tumbleweed romance. Captain, will we be shipped back to New Orleans anytime soon, now with the war being over? What? It's just begun. We expect to hear of a declaration of war by Congress any day now. We got a right to take Venus now. All right, go on with you. Get on back to the fort, Sewell ordered. Yes, sir, I said, saluting. I shoved my arms into the pile's straps, shouldered my musket, and marched down from the crater. 100 yards down, I circled around and climbed back up and walked along the rim of the crater, away from the old lunar camp. I figured if I was the one who nabbed the metal traitor, I'd be a hero. I still wasn't rid of all my foolish ideas. Thank you for listening. So I'm going to try to talk about how I came to write Moonfest Destiny in the way that I did. Well, for starters, very excited about literature and history and ideas. And I had so much energy. With so much energy, and I was reading 19th century authors, Hawthorne, Melville, Poe, thinking about the themes and puzzling on the contradictions. I did not plot out the whole novel when I started, and I did not know where it was going to go. I can very well understand how this can be challenging to readers, heavy with historical references and philosophical ideas. It's not devoid of characters or plot, but I suppose there are other ways to suggest ideas as opposed to talking about them explicitly. I was hoping that the unusual character of the Metal Man and the mystery of what he represents and what animates him would help drive the interest of the reader. He's an unusual character in this context, and we will find out more about him very soon. The editor of the magazine Yawning Vortex compared Prince President Franklin Stowe with Ambrose Bierce's automaton. That story is called Moxon's Master. Reading and thinking about Young America and Manifest Destiny and early industrial America led me to frame this story the way it is. But I don't think I anticipated the way the war would drive it deeper into grim and dark themes. Technically, I do not think it is science fiction. It is historical fantasy. But certainly some publishers who said they did not want to publish it used the excuse that they did not publish science fiction. But it's not science fiction. Well, that conversation would not go anywhere. Another question, I'm not sure how clear this is in podcast format, is the vernacular, the way the people speak. Well, I think it is very seductive to have that kind of a swing in speech. It may be sometimes harder to read that way. In the earlier podcast notes, I mentioned when I was living in Mexico, I wrote drafts of several novels. I took this kind of approach even farther in one. Farther in historical ideas and excitement about literature and literary language. I think I took it to an extreme, which is why I don't think anyone will ever read it. Maybe when I explain the ideas, you can understand my excitement about it. Okay, I read Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Perhaps you have too. Almost all of the movies are not like the original book. So, spoiler, at the end of the book, Frankenstein, the monster, vows to go to the North Pole and build a pyre and burn himself to death. Well, how is he going to do that? There's no wood at the North Pole. He has his dog sleds, if his dogs are still alive. That's not very much wood. And he's a pretty tough creature, so didn't seem to me that he would succeed in that. So I wrote a sequel to Frankenstein and explains what happened to him in the intervening years and his mostly involuntary migration to the United States in the time of the Civil War. And, okay, have you heard of the writer Balzac, Honoré de Balzac? He has a cycle of novels called The Human Comedy. And there is a criminal genius named, well, he has many names. One is Vautrin, and one other is the nickname Cheat Death, Trompe la Mort. He's a character in there. And Edgar Allan Poe. He has a couple stories with a detective genius named Auguste Dupin. A gothic genius, solver of mysteries. Murders in the Rue Morgue is very good, I recommend it. So, this novel brings these three characters together. Frankenstein, Poe's detective genius, Balzac's criminal genius. Well, maybe you can understand that idea could have some potential. But I took it in another step, and I used the excited prose style of another 19th century writer, Thomas Carlyle. He writes in a excited and energetic manner. I think he influenced Melville. So as you can see, I took all of these ideas and my excitement about it, and worked on that book for 2 years and finished it. But I don't think too many people would be interested. So after that, I determined to write more simply. And also, as a way of helping myself do so, to write about my own times. I wrote a satire, Flying Saucers Over Hennepin, published by Permeable Press in 1997. And I wrote other novels not yet published. I wrote several dozen bicycle stories, most of them humorous, sometimes fantastic, published in an Oregon bicycle magazine. And I serialized a bicycle adventure novel in that magazine. I recently rewrote it, and so I will be releasing these projects soon. But first, I have one more novel I wrote in San Miguel back in 91, and the current title is Mysterious Matters of Max Meters. You have perhaps heard of literary minimalism. I did not care for what I felt that stood for, basic hopelessness and resignation. That is not how I wanted to approach my literary efforts or my outlook at the world as a young guy, ambitious in his 20s, and a Smith Corona typewriter. I read somewhere that Jack Kerouac, wrote On the Road on a long roll of teletype paper. Later in my life, I also heard it wasn't true, that it was a myth, but I actually saw it, and it does exist. And I saw that the original has a lot of F-words that they took out. Well, I took that idea with my tremendous energy, didn't want to be slowed down by the mechanical action of taking out paper out of the Smith Corona, putting a new one, making sure it's aligned right. I don't know if anybody listening remembers those small concerns. The mechanical process of typing. So I picked up, it wasn't teletype paper, but you may recall the old dot matrix printer and the type of paper that fed into it. It was linked together with lightly scored edges, and it had periphery strips with holes in it that fed into gears. Well, I took off the periphery pieces, and it would feed right into the Smith Corona as one long strip. Then I banged out this novel, which I called a maximalist style in rebellion to the minimalist hopeless style, set in the 1980s. It's not at all like Moonfest Destiny. Love story, friendship, can people change their nature? And interested in the sound and taste of words. Sometimes it even tries to make up its own new words to find expression for something the character is feeling. That's currently available on paper and also on Kindle. My website is dangerquestmysteries.com. If you would like to email me and say something nice, petergelman@yahoo.com. Thank you again for listening. Moonfest Destiny is available on Kindle for 99 cents.